this week's Brown Art Network episode, we'll be having a conversation with Tenzila in her writing career and all about her area of expertise, leveraging art for change. Tenzila Ahmed is a political strategist, storyteller, and artist based in Los Angeles. She spent the majority of her life dancing at the intersection of activism and art as a South Asian Muslim second-generation immigrant American woman. She recently released her poetry book called Grasping at the Planet Just to Believe, which is a poetry collection that was written over each Ramadan for the last 10 years. For those who don't know, Ramadan is a holiday, the holy month of prayer and fasting for Muslims. And so we're so excited to talk with her. And without much further ado, welcome Tenzila. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started as a writer and artist?
Yeah. So I am an activist and artist here in Los Angeles. I've been doing work in community organizing and art for, oh my gosh, now like 25 years. I started actually in the world of politics. I think that's my background. I was registering people to vote, getting them out to vote, was doing a lot of voter registration stuff. And I was in DC when September 11th happened. And it was like 3 months after I had graduated college. And before then, I had never really done much when it comes to South Asian organizing. There actually wasn't like that much going on before when it comes to like the kind of organizing we see now. And I was registering people to vote, and I was registering like environmental kids to vote. So they were all like white environmental hippies.
Right.
And we saw so many things happening to the South Asian community with the post 9/11 backlash. People were getting hate crimed. There were, you know, lots of surveillance happening. And I just knew that if we like registered and got people out to vote and built up our political power, that, that people would have to pay attention to us. So I started an organization called South Asian American Voting Youth. And in the process of starting this organization, we were going to college campuses and registering young South Asians to vote on all these college campuses. I was like my early 20s. One of the things that I realized was that like voting isn't cool. Like it wasn't like people weren't excited to vote, but I had to figure out how to make it appealable to brown people. So I was doing like making all this like marketing content that was had like South Asian figures that were turning out to vote. I had made stickers that said I'm South Asian and I vote. And through that process, I was really like spending a lot of time thinking about like what kind of stories are we telling about our community to empower our community? And how are we building up this like political power when it comes to being brown, but also like what kind of art and story are we telling to keep people engaged? And that kind of really put me down this path of both like being an activist and like trying to like build up power for our community, but also how do we make art that's speaking to this, and how do we get people interested in politics, which is typically so boring. And it's been really fun and interesting and hard, and you know, it's a tough place to be at, but it's been cool to be able to be doing this work for like, you know, 25 years now, and like seeing how over time culture has shifted because of the work.
Right.
Yeah, that's really cool. I think you're right. It's very hard to get people engaged, especially into voting. I feel like that's still true today.
Constantly.
Especially with the climate of how things are going right now for our country, it's like more important to vote, but it's really hard to get people to kind of like want to contribute to the whole process. I guess out of curiosity, from looking when you started to now, do you see some of the similar challenges that you had to face earlier on in when you started, or has things changed for the better in certain areas? Like, how does it seem like now with everything that's going on?
I mean, that's such a loaded question, especially like in this, like, you know, like 6 months into this like bombing of Gaza. I think one of the things that's been really difficult has been seeing that our current administration, our president, hasn't like taken a real stance against Israel and hasn't said anything about Palestine. And, you know, like Like, we did so much work to get, well, I didn't do that much work to get Biden in power, but we did a lot of work to get South Asians electing for the Democratic candidates for presidents. And it was one, it's just like one of those things where you're just like, oh, like these people in power, these politicians who we'd worked so hard to get into power aren't like listening to us when we're trying to hold them accountable to our vote. So one of the exciting things that I thought from this election cycle was the, they weren't the undecided voters. They were the protest voters, and they were voting like third party, or they were voting depending on it, like depending on what state you were. And so I thought that was really interesting. It was an interesting way to show that like we are turning out to vote, we are making choices, and we're choosing not to vote you. We're not like being forced to vote in this two-party system where like protest voting and saying like we want a third party, we want to not just be part of the status quo. Mm-hmm. I think like that's been like really difficult, I think, for me, especially since I've been working in democracy for like all this time, is that, you know, I did a lot of work to turn out South Asian voters. I did a lot of work to turn out Asian American voters. I think when I did the math last time, I've turned out like 500,000 voters. And to know that like that work is being ignored, you know, like we're doing all this work, like, because before when I first started, everyone was a little, like, was saying like, oh, people aren't listening to South Asian communities because they don't vote. Well, I debunked that. I literally have turned out so many people to vote and they're still not listening to us. So that's the part where I'm just kind of, you know, I don't want to say like losing faith, but also like it really shows that sometimes democracy is just kind of like a facade and we have to do the real organizing. You know, props to all the students on these college campuses who are turning out in such great numbers, like, what, 21 students at Barnard were kicked out of school this week, and then Columbia's been having sit-ins, and I just saw something about UPenn. Like, everyone is like standing up and saying like, you know, clearly you're not listening to us as voters, so we're gonna be disruptors, we're gonna make you listen to us no matter what. And I think that's the fun part about organizing. It's like, it's not just about doing electoral organizing, but it's about like, how else can we show power to force these people to listen to us?
Right. And I mean, I agree. I think it is kind of disheartening to see everything that's going on. It's almost like it's very obvious that there's certain people in power that clearly don't necessarily, they run on the assumption that they're representing a whole people, but mm-hmm. when it comes to actually representing the people, there's always the, oh, but no, that's not necessarily my job description. Oh, we don't necessarily have to do that. And it doesn't seem like there seems to be a disconnect between those two things. And it is very disheartening to see.
Being run by the lobbyists, like these very powerful money organizations that have like, have them, you know, on a puppet string. So they're forcing them to not listen. Like, there's no reason why NYPD arrested all those students at Columbia. Mm-hmm. And even when the NYPD said that the only reason why they did it was because the president of the university asked them to do it. Like, they're like, oh, we didn't have to do this. The president asked us to do this. It's because that's all money that's driving it. That wasn't a safety concern. That wasn't a, you know, like, students have a long history of protesting on college campuses. There's definitely like people in power with money that are forcing their hand on these issues.
Yeah, and I think going back to like your original, like, you know, getting, you know, you spent so much of your life trying to get people to vote, and now it's like getting harder and harder to convince them to do that, because at the end of the day, like, what are you trying to convince them to do, and is that gonna actually represent what their voices? And I don't know, it is a thing that I've thought about quite a bit, at least in the last couple of, it makes me nervous for the next 6 or 7 months leading up to the election, I think, for sure.
100%.
Yeah,
I'm incredibly concerned about the two-party system choices that we've been left with.
Right.
Yeah. Kind of shifting gears a little bit, We also on our podcast would like to talk a little bit about our identity growing up and how that's kind of played an impact in some of the choices that we've made or maybe career decisions. So kind of wanted to ask you what your relationship is with your identity being South Asian American, and then kind of growing up to now, how your perspective of your identity has changed.
Yeah, I think for me growing up, you know, my family's from Bangladesh. They moved to LA, and then I think my dad moved like right after the 1965 Immigration Act. So he moved out here in like 68. My mom came out here in like 78. And then I was born in LA. I was born and raised in LA. And I was raised around like a very large like Bangladeshi community and Muslim community, but like I didn't really understand what it like. We didn't have other South Asians in our network. And I didn't like know that there was different ways to be South Asian outside of like the cultural references. And I knew I wanted to be an activist. I knew I wanted to like push back on like the narrative that was imposed on me. So like I was definitely like a rebellious, like anti-brown kid growing up. Maybe like not anti-brown, but I was anti like doctors and engineer brown. Mm-hmm. Like I was like, I want to make a difference in the world. And I was told that like I had to like whatever, get an arranged marriage and, you know, only be an engineer or something. You know, like right. That was the narrative I was pushing back on, that like that like expectation expected of me. So I like really moved into this like wanting to be, and I was like, well, who are brown people that are doing activist things? And I couldn't find much back in when I was in college in like the late 90s. Well, yeah, I was in college from 97 to 2001. So everything changed for me when 9/11 happened. Like it was such a before and after there. And it was like one of those things where you were just like, oh, like everything I do from here on out is gonna be different because I'm brown. Like grassroots organizing, doing anything as a brown person just like completely changed after 9/11. I don't know. It's just like really hard to explain like how different the world was to be a brown person before 9/11, after 9/11. Right. So after that, like I started this organization called South Asian American Voting Youth, and we were on all these college campuses, and I didn't know that many brown activists. And then all of a sudden people were like, oh, there's this person who works at Greenpeace. And then there's this person who works for the Democratic Party. And like, I created this like board of young 20 something, 30 something South Asians that were making a difference. And that like completely changed like my life, like being able to like have this community of people that were my kind of brown people, the ones that were like making a difference in the world, and just like bringing them all together and then organizing with them and like getting out the vote. Like getting out the vote was one thing, but like having this community of people that I could organize with like really changed my idea of what it means to be brown and like making a voice for brown people. Since then, like every project that I've done, like I've always had, like I keep finding like young South Asians that are on the margins, and I like finding them and pulling them into like different projects, and then just having this like incredible network. And now it's like, there's so many of us, and it's like so great to have this like community of South Asians doing like activist work. And that is like my identity of what it means to be brown. Like I can't imagine any other way of existing as a South Asian. And just like our community is so rich, full of these people that are, you know, on the margins.
Right. No, and it's really great that you were able to harness that and find that community and build that community for so long. And I think that's definitely, I'm sure, made a huge impact on all the people that you've kind of managed or got to know and talk to and built up over the years. I think that's so exciting to hear.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you really like carved out a little community in California, which and probably farther out. And that's exciting to see. How did you get, I mean, you talked a little bit about how you got started as a political strategist and like get into political activism. When did you start using your skills and talent in writing and art, like creative, on the creative side to kind of push forward your positive change or the things that you're trying to advocate for.
It was a little bit two part. So like one part was there was this blog called Sepia Mutiny. Mm. We're the largest South Asian American blog from like, I think it was started in like 2006 and we went until 2012. Or maybe it was like 2004. We had like, this was like back when blogging was really big and everyone who was South Asian on the internet had their own blog where they were telling their own stories of their lives. But at CP Mutiny, it was a group blog and we were all like tasked with the idea of like writing something South Asian. And we would have like 3 to 4 posts a day and we would just like on the internet, like scouring the internet, finding like different like pop culture, political, we were writing about anything brown.
Right.
And being in that space, like I was a guest blogger and then I got invited on to be, to write more frequently. And just being on the space and like writing about like our community and really like documenting what was happening really like forced like me to harness, like polish my writing chops to be like a fast writer too. And everyone else was, I don't know what everyone else was writing. They were like writing like some stuff, but like I was really interested in pop culture and I was really interested in punk music and, you know, just like alternative kinds of topics that the other bloggers weren't writing about. So I would either write about like activism or I would write about like pop culture. And that became kind of like my niche of like where I was writing about being South Asian. And the recipe that I came up with at the time was like, okay, I have to write like 50-50, like half of my content is gonna be pop culture and half of it is gonna be politics, because people were like, after a while, people would like look at the who was writing it and they would kind of skip them if they didn't like the topic. And I figured that with this formula, people were more likely to like read what I was writing. And that's like something that I've been using like throughout the rest of my life. I've always been kind of very conscious of doing like navigating between pop culture and politics very specifically. So I was writing there. And then like, I was also like, in grad school and I was learning about like critical race theory and learning about telling counter narratives of the community. And I really saw CP Mutiny as like this radical space of counter narrative storytelling for the South Asian community. And I think this whole concept of counter narratives are like the stories that we tell from marginalized communities. And it's a way of empowering our own community. And I really thought of blogs and storytelling as doing that. Like we're literally telling the counter narratives of our community. And that's kind of like how I got started in like that aspect of storytelling for our community. But I was always like really reluctant to be very vulnerable about my personal narrative. Like I was always like, I'm just doing this for South Asians, but I'm not like, I like never like shared too much about myself. One of the big things was like, because we had a lot of trolls on the site and we had a lot of haters and I was a, you know, Muslim woman writing on the site and I like I was like scared to be vulnerable because we didn't really have a lot of like internet security protocol that we do now back then.
Right. Yeah.
But then like I got invited to contribute to this book called Love Inshallah. It's called Love Inshallah, The Secret Love Lives of American Muslim Women. And I wrote a story for that book that about like falling in love with like a guy in a rock band. And that turned into like another pivotal point in my writing career where like people were drawn to my writing. They were drawn to the vulnerability that I shared in my writing. And then that like made me realize that like one of the best ways to move people is to like share your vulnerability with other people and to be able to touch people through their hearts, not just through their brains or through pop culture. And so that really got me started on a path of like doing like true, deep, like personal storytelling. And so since then I've been like writing a lot of like personal essays and I just like swished up how I was telling stories. I became more vulnerable in how I told stories and poetry through that process.
That's really cool. I think I also saw on your website that you also did like public speaking events as well, and you kind of tap into other mediums outside of writing. Just out of curiosity, is that a very similar process that you kind of got into that as well? Kind of just naturally went from writing to just speaking about things?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, like I was doing a lot of workshops because I was because of the election stuff. So, but that I think when you're like when you're you just get pulled into these speaking engagements. I don't really like the speaking part. Like I, whenever time I do speak, I always kind of treat it like a workshop. I don't really like giving the speech aspect of it, but I like doing workshops. I taught this past quarter, I taught at UCLA, I taught a course on South Asian American communities. And I'm such a workshop person. I was like, I'm going to do like interactive things with the students. And then the person I was like co-teaching with, she was doing lectures. So she was just like lecturing. I was like, I can't do that. I can't talk at people. I'm definitely how do we create breakout groups and talk about this with each other kind of a person.
What kind of conversations would you have in these workshops? Like, for example, the South Asian kind of course, like art. And well, that's one question. The other question is like, do you have more students who are South Asian in your classes, or is it kind of a good mix between South Asian and, you know, other, I don't know, like, I'm just curious on like what, you know, like,
yeah,
how many people who's like, that's so exciting to have a course like that be offered at a public university. I don't like, yeah. I personally have never seen something like that specific to South Asians. Like, that's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been an effort on a lot of college campuses to like force Asian American studies to create like South Asian American minors or South Asian American majors. We basically focused the first half of the class on the Gother Party. The Gother Party was the revolutionary community group that started in 1912. That started on the West Coast, like from Astoria all the way down to San Diego. There was all these like Bengali intellectuals and Punjabi farmers that would get together and they would learn from each other. And the purpose was to kick the English out of India. So this was, so they would organize here a revolutionary movement. Then they would like send people back to India to overthrow the British out of India. This was one of the narratives I was really drawn to as an activist because, you know, like I said, like I grew up thinking that like we came at like in the 1960s and we were all supposed to be doctors and engineers. And I didn't realize that we had like radical roots on the West Coast of being brown from 100 years ago. Like that was so empowering to me. And that really like helped me realize that like being here as a brown activist is this is our legacy. Like we're building on like historical legacy. This isn't a new thing. And then what else do we, then we also talk about like, because it was UCLA, we did a lot of West Coast stuff. So there's like, we talked about the Punjabi farmers that would come through. We talked about the Kumagatu Maru. We talked about, then we went into like talking about like 9/11. We talked about 9/11 for like 2-3 classes. And then we talked about food and pop culture and movies and stuff like that. It was only 10 weeks because it was a short quarter, but it was a lot of fun.
That is exciting. Yeah. I don't know. When you said South Asian class, I was like, what? Like, is it a history? Like, what are we talking about? And that's really exciting. It's like so specific to like South Asian American history.
Yeah, yeah. We were doing South Asian American history. Yeah. We were specifically like, and then we also talked about like domestic violence issues and like gender issues too. So, and the final project was a podcast. We had all of our students make a podcast about like something that they learned, which obviously fits in with the work that you two are doing.
Right. That's awesome.
That's really cool. So I think
you guys would have gotten A's.
Oh, thank you. Thank
you. Yeah. I was like, so I guess for background, Sneha and I both grew up in the Midwest. And then I'm also out here in LA. So when I first moved from growing up only in the Midwest to like here and seeing how much more diverse the South Asian community is over here, it was just like really eye-opening for me where I was just like, wow, there's more identities within our community than just what I've kind of grown up with.
Totally.
Yeah. And out of curiosity, what was the feedback that your students had for you with going after going through that class, because I don't think we'd ever have an opportunity to take a class like that back home.
I think they thought it was hard. I know that was definitely one of the feedbacks. But I think they were kind of expecting an easy A out of the course, but it was definitely difficult. But from the podcast, like everyone like talked to, like they were really inspired by the class, and they like were really, at least the South Asian students were really inspired by the class. They like said, like you said, like they never had the opportunity to learn anything like this before.
Right.
You know, this class, like I taught it with someone who's been teaching it for a while, but I actually started doing South Asian American history work when I started Bay Area Solidarity Summer up in Oakland. So I was part of the founding of that in the 2010s. There was like a string of like South Asian American youth activist camps all across the country. So there was, you know, ICASU on the East Coast, there was one in Texas, there was Cedar in Chicago, there was one in the Bay Area. So I helped start the one in the Bay Area. And for that camp, we were focusing it on like South Asians from the age 14 to like 21. And the goal of the camp was like a 5-day camp. And we wanted to create a camp that we wish we had as South Asian kids growing up. So we wanted to like teach South Asian youth all the things that we didn't have access to. So I taught the radical history timeline. So that we would always start the weekend with the radical history timeline workshop. And in the figuring out what to put into the radical history timeline, that like became my like obsession with South Asian American radical history. It's like, what is our history? What do I want to share? Like, am I sharing the narrative of the Bengali guy who started Bose headphones, or am I starting like sharing the narrative of the Gother party in San Francisco? You know, so then mm-hmm. then you're like picking and choosing like what does radical mean to me, and what does radical mean for everyone else? And that workshop turned into like that workshop turned into so much more. So now I would do the workshop for people like in community groups. Anirvan and Bernali, who were part of Bay Area Solidarity Summer, they turned that workshop and they turned it into the Berkeley South Asian American Radical Walking Tour. And so now if you're in Berkeley on weekends, you can take this walking tour with them and they'll just kind of like walk you around Berkeley and tell you the local history of what's happening in Berkeley. And every time I see them, Anirvan's like, yeah, we started this because of our workshop at Bay Area Solidarity Summer. I was like, yeah, like it's cool to see like this is how we are telling our own narratives of what it means to be South Asian in the U.S.
Yeah, and the impact. Yeah, I definitely think hearing more of that or learning more of that will help in terms of people's relationship with the culture or with the identity, because a lot of times that's like the biggest problem, what we see. I mean, I don't know, like our growing up, the media, it was very like, it was a very one identity.
100%, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think learning this would be more appreciative of like the other areas that we most probably will not get kind of growing up with the culture, or maybe lack of the culture. So that's really cool that that's the impact that you were able to have.
When the riots were all the Black Lives Movement uprising mm-hmm. was happening in the 2020s, it was like 2020, 2021, right? In the first year or two of the pandemic. I would always talk about the Bellingham Race Riot of 1907, which happened in, I think it was in, where's Bellingham? Bellingham's in Washington State. So like the race riots happened because there's all these like South Asian workers in the paper mills up there, and they were pushed out of the city by white workers who were mad that they were taking their jobs. And I would always bring that up when people were talking about, you know, the uprising of Black folks, because there's this kind of like ignorance among South Asians about like how we were never involved in a race riot, when actually like we have like 100 years ago, we too were being kicked out of a city because of our race and because we were being told we were taking jobs. And so that's definitely something that I like using history to be able to explain to people that like, we're not brand new. We have a history in this country of this happening to us. And that's why we need to build solidarity with one another. And I think that's so important, because otherwise, we're just kind of like, you know, the, you know, elite class of South Asians who are just kind of like trying to like you know, bootstrap themselves and say like, oh, we're just like everyone else. Right. You know, they get to like pretend, but like actually, like, we have such a deep history of being rebels and activists in this country that we can't just like ignore. We can't ignore that as a community. We have to like honor it.
I was going to say, it is crazy that like all these things, like, I mean, I'm being educated like live right now. I genuinely had no idea about any of these things that you're saying. Like, I mean, and I guess that, and like, I guess Kirti had mentioned, like, we did grow up in a very specific type of Indian community, albeit a very large Indian community. I'm very grateful to have the amount of Indian people we knew, but I think we all were kind of, I don't want to, like, lack of the term, like, brainwashed into thinking very specific things about our own culture. Like, there are a lot of, like, I guess, internalized racism within our our community that, it is, like, times like this where I'm like, wow, I feel like I just learned something new about our history, and, like, there's definitely more to our identity than what we were told or what we told each other, as you will.
Well, definitely shout out a resource for other people that want to learn. There's the South Asian American Digital Archives. Okay. And so, like, they started in 20, I don't even know when they started, but they've been around for a long time. They have been collecting narratives for the South Asian community. They like collecting documents because it's an archive. Mm-hmm. But they also created this book. They created a textbook. I forgot what the textbook was called, but for when we were teaching our class, we leaned heavily on the textbook. It's a very easy textbook. It's, you know, it's like written so that like a 15-year-old high school student could learn from it. In our college class, we were using the book, and that's what we would assign our readings from, because it was just easy to like assign it, and just like you could read it easily and you could like learn a lot of content. Highly recommend the book, but also Sada is a great resource. And I think Sada would actually be really interested in your podcast. So I think you guys should definitely reach out to them. Great. They always have like grants and project funding available for smaller groups to make things. I think this totally fits into what they're doing.
Oh, that's really cool. Definitely. I just took a note. So I definitely will look into that and learn more. So thanks for the shout out, and hopefully listeners too. kind of going with that, I guess. I know we talked a little bit about like how you got started and the type of work that you've kind of learned to use to kind of uplift the topics that you want to advocate for. With that, what are some challenges that you've faced when you bring awareness to certain issues? Because I know a lot, they're all really heavy hitters. And so I guess, is there some challenges that you've faced, and then how did you like go, I guess, filter through all the negative social media and the fluff that we see on the news? Like, how does that impact your work as well?
I mean, I think one of the most consistent things, no matter what the medium has been like haters either for me being Muslim, or haters for me being a woman, or just haters. There's like so many haters. Like, I think that has been sadly like one of the most consistent things that I've had to experience on CP Mutiny, because CP Mutiny was like a largely South Asian American blog, but I was the only like Muslim Bangladeshi on it. Like, I would get like usually like male incel Hindu Indian haters. It's a very like specific type of haters, but they would always attack me on CP Mutiny. When I was on, when we had our podcast, Good Muslim, Bad Muslim, like, we got less haters because, like you have to listen to the podcast, and, like, the haters didn't want to listen to it. They, like, only, like, would hate to, like, whatever your title was, which made it easier, right? We didn't get that much hate, but we would definitely get Islamophobes on for that. We also got, like, haters that were, like, Muslim haters, because, like, we weren't, like, being good Muslim enough for them. Mm-hmm. So we got a lot of that. Like, and the haters aspect, it was just been awful. Like, no matter what field. But, you know, like, I learned digital security early on. And that was something that, like, you just kind of have to do when it comes to doing this.
Right. Do you ever find yourself trying to tailor what you say towards the haters in any way? Or is it just like kind of like, oh, there's certain people that are never going to be able to look past certain things and therefore it's not even worth the time and energy? Like, what's your take on trying to respond? Or do you try to respond to these haters in any way?
It's really hard because like the haters kind of like change over the years.
Yeah.
And it's... I try not to respond to them. Like, I try not to like change my content to them. I think one of the things that I was reflecting on when I was looking at your questions was like, you know, when it comes to audience, like I definitely have different audiences depending on what kind of content I'm creating. So when we were doing our podcast, Good Muslim, Bad Muslim, like we did reach out to a lot of non-Muslims. We had a lot of white listeners, yeah. I think because like NPR covered our podcast really early on. Oprah was covering us. We got like a lot of mainstream publicity for our podcast. So we got a lot of non-Muslims listening to us, but we didn't change how we were talking.
Yeah.
Actually came up because like my co-host Zara, she really wanted to like, because we got like one email that was like, please explain your Muslim terminology. And I was talking to Zara. I was like, I don't want to have to explain our Muslim terminology every single podcast. Like, we are recentering our narrative on ourselves. Like, let's only explain to like if we each other don't understand what's happening. Like, but I don't want to have to explain it. And I think that was one of the best decisions we've ever made. I actually ended up writing an essay about this. Like, when 2016 rolled around, we were getting a lot of like society was getting a lot of like anti-Muslim hate because there was a rise in Islamophobia. We got some comments that were all of a sudden like saying like, oh, these are the conversation you two are having is like us eavesdropping on a conversation between two Muslim women. And we're able to learn and we're able to like, we've never been privy to these conversations before. And it's a different kind of learning. And I think that's the kind of conversations we need to be having. We need to be able to like have honest, real conversations. We need to not like explain ourselves to the white gaze, but for them to like listen to us and like learn from that experience is huge. So that was definitely something. When we were doing that podcast, my idea of who I was speaking to was I was speaking to that lone South Asian girl in the Midwest who had no one like them. And that was like my audience. And if I got like white people listening to us, fine. But like that's who my audience was.
Right.
But then like I have other projects. Like I had the Muslim Valentine's Day cards. And for that project, I was making these crass Valentine's Day cards, you know, after like, because like after Love Inshallah, the book came out, people were asking me stupid questions. Like media was asking me stupid questions saying like, do Muslim women love? I was like, yeah, duh. Like, of course we do. So like I made these Muslim Valentine's Day cards. I made 6 every year. It was a 10-year project. But the point of that card was to make people uncomfortable. Like I would have these like really uncomfortable slogans and people were offended by them. And, you know, I had a lot of Muslims offended by them. But my purpose for that one was disruption and like making people think differently. And so for me, like, I'm very specific, like, no matter what the project is, I'm very specific about audience. I'm trying to, like, do something with, like, the message I'm trying to put out there. But I'm not, like, catering to, like, the haters. I'm just trying to, like, make people feel different things depending on what the project is.
Right. No, and I don't think you should, you know. I agree with that.
I think it's also extremely important to, like, to do it the way that how you're catering to your audience, because I know in our South Asian community, like, just talking about politics is such a sensitive matter. I don't know, from the perspective that I have seen, and it's always, well, my family, cause being in the Midwest, and they are like immigrants, they were like, well, just don't talk about it with your friends, or don't even bring it up, because your safety is the biggest priority. And so we were always taught to just like just keep it in, like internalize it, just keep it in. So I think just doing that in itself, like catering it to the individuals who are always taught like you can't really speak out or speak up about it, or like want to show your interest in it, I think is super important, because I think that'll be more helpful and that'll lead to bigger impacts and things.
And it's so true though, like there's such fear we've been experiencing such fear of like speaking out as brown people in the past decade.
Right.
Which I felt like, I mean, we're experiencing that too after 9/11, I guess, but like, it just feels different now. Like the tenor is different. Like before, like after 9/11, we were obviously experiencing racial backlash from 9/11. So like, it felt there was like this kind of like urgency.
Yeah.
And like now it feels like that urgency is gone now, but still like that fear exists. So like, I totally relate to what your parents were telling you, Kirthi. Like just like that fear, like there's just been like so many like murders that have been happening, you know, hate because of hate, which is really unfortunate, and that like it does exist continuously.
Yeah. Kind of switching gears just a little bit, because you have a book that just came out called Grasping at This Planet Just to Believe, which is a collection of poetry that you've collected over the last 10 years, just amazing and really crazy and really awesome to see. Can you tell us a little bit about the book and what made you choose poetry as the medium of expressing these ideas that you have?
Yeah, I started writing poetry after attending this Asian American open mic spot in Los Angeles called Tuesday Night Project. You should come through, Kirthi, if you're in LA.
Yes, for sure.
You should come see it. I performed actually last week at that space.
Oh, cool.
It's been around for like 27 years, and I think when I was in my mid-20s, I was like, I'm going to go, and by the end of the summer, I'm going to like perform on the open mic. And so ever since then, I've like been using poetry as a form of expression. This is actually like my third collection of, like, this is my third book, but this is my first time with a publisher. I'm with Writ Large Press on this one, which I'm really excited about. The project came about because I was doing Poetry a Day for Ramadan, which is something that I came up with. My mother had passed away in 2011, and it was like the first Ramadan after she had died. And I like didn't, you know, like fasting is one way to like be in touch with your spirituality and connecting with God. And for me, I had found such connection to my spirituality with writing poetry that I wanted to do Poetry Day for Ramadan. So I wrote a poem a day that first year, and I was telling people about it, and everyone was like, oh, I want to participate too. So I created this Facebook group, because that's what people were doing back then. They would have Facebook groups, and we would do, I had like a group of like 20 people, and we would write poems a day for Ramadan, and then that grew up to like 50 people, and like over the course of 10 years it grew up to 70 people, and we would get together every Ramadan, it would write a poem a day, and it was really cathartic. It was really like such a great community space. I made so many friends through this space. The only rule was that like you had to be a real person, like someone had to vouch for you so that we knew that you were real, and you had to share one poem a week. And if you didn't share one poem a week, I would kick you out of the group. So we had this kind of like very forced safe space that was created, and my poems came out of that project. I was writing a poem a day, and I have to say, like, one of the really interesting things about doing this, writing a poem a day together, for people that haven't been tracking anti-Muslim hate crimes, is that around Ramadan, there was always kind of like this increase of like hate against Muslims, because that's how racists work. And you would kind of like we would all end up writing about the same incident at the same time. So we were writing, but we were also writing about like the politics of the moment that was happening. And then we were able to like feel together, and we were able to heal together through that process, which is always kind of interesting too. And highly recommend it. Highly recommend having a group of friends that you write poems with together. You don't have to be Muslim to do it for Ramadan. Like I would also do this for National Poetry Month, which is now April. April is National Poetry Month. So I've been in a couple of groups where we would get together and write poems a day for April too. The hard part was that like Facebook group was a great tool when everyone was on Facebook, but now that everyone's migrated off of Facebook, a lot of people don't have Facebook accounts anymore that were in that group. So I haven't found a place where we tried moving to Discord, but like not a lot of people know how to use Discord. So maybe the project's coming to an end just because I don't have a tech platform that like everyone actually wants to use to share poems on. But maybe it's done. 10 years is a long time because we started in 2011. Now we're like in 2024. It's a long time for a project.
Yeah, and the most probably was a lot of content in across the 10 years. I guess when you reflect back, is there anything that you felt like you've learned when you garnered that community together? Like, is there like a specific story or a specific like memory you have in that creation process that really like stuck to you?
Yeah. I mean, one of the cool things about that group was because of who I know, is that we had some like. We had some really famous poets in that group, and then we had really brand new poets to that group who don't even consider themselves poets. So we were able to create kind of this space where you you had the breadth of like skills or people who think of themselves as poets. And we also like had a lot of it was open to Muslim and Muslim-ish people. So there was people who like maybe practiced fasting for Ramadan, but didn't like, you know, convert completely. Or we had people that were in our community that were just South Asian and just like were friends with a lot of us that were in the group. So that was also interesting too, because I didn't want to be like defining who was Muslim for this group, but I just wanted people, like it was like Muslim and allies, but I don't really consider them allies in this kind of space, because I felt like they were kind of like more Muslimish than allies. Anyways, I didn't want to like place an identity marker on them. I just wanted it to be an open space that was like open to all kinds of people. Right. And so that was also interesting too, is like, they had to be people who like understood, but like, I don't know. Like people have such different ideas of like identifying as Muslim. They're like, oh, I'm not like Muslim because of how my parents raised me. Like people, but then I think this space, like by creating an open space where you had like all kinds of different ways of identifying as Muslim, people were able to come to this like their own spirituality in their own way. And I thought that was really interesting and really important. Mainly because like for me, I really grew up in like this, as a teenager, I grew up with a very dogmatic idea of what it means to be Muslim. I didn't know that there was all these other ways of being Muslim or all these other ways of being brown. And so I really wanted to like be both in like the Poetry A Day group, but in like all my projects, like I want to like be open and allow other kinds of people to come in so that everyone could like explore and discover in their own way.
Right.
One of the cool things about like the podcast that like one of the cool things about Good Muslim, Bad Muslim podcast was like, I've had people come up to me and say like, I converted to Islam because of what I heard in your podcast. I was like, that's so weird, 'cause we're not like a Muslim podcast like that. But they were dating, this one person was dating a guy that was Muslim. And then like for her to like learn about Islam and like her now husband was like, she would use our podcast. And I was like, oh, like, I think that's kind of what having open content in whether it's poetry or books or podcast or blogs, you know, like having these kind of spaces where people can like explore and discover and make their own conclusions. Like that's kind of like the purpose of like making content like this, is so that people can have that space to explore.
Yeah. I mean, and kind of getting into that a little bit, like when people read your collection, what do you hope they gain from reading the stories? You know, what do you hope they gain?
I don't know. I feel like poetry is like such a emotional kind of a space. Like I hope people just like read it and then they feel something. Yeah. And I think poetry and visual art, like they're the medium that I make where I don't need people to learn anything from it. I just want them to feel something from it.
Right.
And so hopefully people feel something from it. We'll see.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading it. I know you gave us a PDF version, so we're looking forward to reading and kind of diving into it as well.
Good.
As we kind of wrap up the episode today, what we would like to kind of end our conversation with is like for individuals who are listeners who are kind of in a similar thought process to you, kind of hearing your stories of how you've kind of gotten to your career, what you've kind of gone through. if you could advise those individuals who are looking to get into like art or even activism and or just being passionate about a specific topic that they want to uplift in a specific community or bring awareness to, like what would be the advice that you'd give them as they get started in that?
I think just to play, like there's so many mediums out there and there's so many ways to like experiment with mediums. Just don't like not do anything because you're afraid of being perfect. Just jump in, play, make something, make bad art, make lots of bad art, make lots of good art, you know, just make something. Like don't stop yourself and say like, I can't do anything because it has to be perfect. Like don't do that to yourself. Just like go out there and make something. And like go get inspired. Like go see things, go experience things, go participate in things. One of the things that I had an art show last year. One of the things that I did before, well, not before, but like all of last year was I went to one art show a week. And I was like, I just really want to go and like, I want to like experience other people's artwork so that I can be inspired. And then I know I like in the past I've done like one poetry event a week, just to intake it. So like, I think you have to be intentional about like letting yourself be inspired by other people's work.
Right.
I wish I could say like read a book a week too, but I'm such a slow reader.
So no, I mean, yeah, honestly, same. But
I didn't make that recommendation.
No, I think that's great advice, and I hope that anyone who's listening can take that and run with it, because I think that is something that I think we can always afford more South Asian creatives in this industry and in other industries, and we need more brown people everywhere. So I'm here for this. And thank you for that advice. Thank you for the conversation that we've had. I feel like I've gained so much just personally about this conversation. So really great to be able to have that. And with that, we will conclude this episode of Brown Art Network. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no, and if you would like to get in touch with Tanzila or want more information on her recent poetry collection, we'll put her website and social media and everything in our description under the episode so you guys can check it out. Tanzila, thank you so much for coming, and I hope to see more of you in the future.
Yeah, I hope so too. I hope you can come to LA and come to one of these art shows or performances.
I'm sure Kirti will make some.
I'm ready to go. Please. Yes. Yeah. I'm so excited. Yes.
All right. Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.